You're listening to Bedroom Beethovens, where notable music makers break down stories accompanied by songs and melodies documenting growth through their 10,000-hour journey. And me? Well, my name is Cello, your host.
I am a bedroom Beethoven.
Hey everybody, welcome to episode 127 of the podcast.
My guest this week is...
My name is Fat Tony. I'm a rapper from Third Ward, Houston, Texas. I've made a lot of albums with the producer Goldeneye, formerly known as Tom Cruise. Made an album with Tay Dex. I have the side project Charger to the Game. I've worked with A$AP Rocky, Bun B, a whole bunch of talented motherfuckers, but...
From the vagina to the recliner. Yes, sir.
That's right, baby. The rooter to the tutor. You get the lingo.
Walked in the store with 20 for the slots. Left with a dollar and a lotto ticket got. Back in the car and went back to the block. Now we in the house cooking up a new plot. First it was stocks, then weed crops. When they both failed, he ain't bail. Could have invested in CBD, passed on it. When it blew up, he was like doggone it. Trying to make an app, but that backfired. Amazon made one and it was more fire. You can bet he ain't turning down nothing but his collar. Even if he down to his last damn dollar. Wife came to him and said, this ain't cute. To go to a support group. When he walked in, he knew he wouldn't be back. And when his wife asked him, he said, fuck that. I'm a gambling man.
Crazy week, because I just moved for a few months to an Airbnb in the Third Ward of Houston with my family, and my guest this week is also from the Third Ward. I don't know if that's fate or destiny, but perhaps this podcast episode just had to be made, even though the game is to be sold, not to be told. Storytelling isn't merely a vehicle for self-expression, it's a mode of transportation, a two-way mirror in which we process gilded dreams and grotesque nightmares, the transgression of cultural taboos and the upholding of ancient tradition. It's also the animating idea behind much of the greatest popular music ever made. Consider Exotica. Yeah? It's the new album from Houston, Polymath, Fat Tony, the latest entry in that fabled tradition, what Outkast once described as shooting game in the form of story rapping. And with that, I seem to be everywhere nowadays. And if you like this podcast, you're in luck, as this show is available on all streaming platforms, YouTube, Instagram, Twitter, and like Bob Dylan once famously said, that an artist should always be in the state of becoming. And in the case of Fat Tony, Exotica is the latest stage in an evolution. And we get very Texas on this episode. Shout out to the Boss Man, J57, the whole 5-7 Collective, my new hometown of Houston, Texas. And shout out to Joel Anthony and all my Patreons. I appreciate you. Let's get the show started.
Just to make a buck, I'm a gambling man. Put it all on the line. Make it back next time. I'm a gambling man.
They say it's, you know, your music is somewhere between DJ Screw and Bad Brains, but more accurately, I'd say you're between DJ Screw and Minor Threat, personally.
Oh, nice, nice. Hey, man, I love them both. You know, Minor Threat definitely was a big influence for me when I was a kid. That's the first time that I think I ever saw a band kind of operate at a professional level and be that young, even though they didn't happen during my time. Obviously, I'm like looking back in like retrospect, but... Yeah, they were definitely some of the first people that I saw, like, actually, you know, having their own label, booking their own tours, writing songs, trying to grow, you know what I mean?
And they're from the same area as Bad Brains. And the Ergs, they're from the Jersey, D.C. area, too.
Great people. Mikey Erg, that's my motherfucking guy. I brought him to Bun B's birthday party at South by Southwest a couple years ago. We had a blast.
Yeah, you're, you know, I'll bring it back to Texas. You're catching me at a weird time in my life. I was born in Central Texas. I've been in Texas my whole entire life. There's nothing that you can't tell me about DJ Screw, the screwed up click, the color changing click, UGK. I've been listening to Lil Flip when he was just a leprechaun on a cereal box, you know, Fat Pat.
Oh, yeah.
Big Pokey. I know it all. But this Sunday, I'm happy to announce that I'm moving to Houston. I'm getting a house built.
Wow, that's what's up.
I'm getting a house built in Richmond. And my wife, she got a new job in Sugar Land. So
nice.
Yeah.
Houston's a great place. I feel like, you know, especially growing up when I did in Houston, I was very lucky to be in a city where there was so much action, like so many great artists, so many great songs that would go on to be classics were like new when I was a kid and I saw them happening and it felt like music wasn't that far away. You know what I mean? It didn't feel like it couldn't be done because it was happening all around you, like on the radio, right? When I was a kid, you would hear Master P right alongside Lil Kiki or Scarface, you know, all these people of like varying levels of quote unquote fame or whatever, you know, they're all being presented to us as Houstonians on the same page. It's a beautiful thing.
And what's cool is my daughter's six, so she's young enough to where she can say, oh yeah, I grew up in Houston. So I'm trying to be like you.
That's
a little
what's
bit.
Up. Yeah. Hey man, you're doing the right thing.
now Bedroom Beethoven, Fat Tony, we talked about this, the very origins of your musical career. You set out to be a producer, but you were also in the eighth grade. So of course it was called Simply Throwed.
Yes, exactly. That was the name of my first little crew, Simply Throwed Entertainment.
How throwed were you guys at 13 years old?
I mean, we were nasty. I thought that we were great rhymers. You know what I mean? We were taking rapping very seriously. Very, very seriously.
Well, tell me what Oh Boy by Cam'ron meant to you.
Wow. Okay. You done your motherfucking research. Because Oh Boy is the first song. All right. So when I was in eighth grade, I was late to class and I always had my Walkman with me because I was always listening to radio or to a tape or whatever. I was walking in class and I hear Cam'ron, Juel Santana, Just Blaze, Oh Boy for the very first time on the radio. And it stops me in my fucking tracks. I'm listening to the song and I'm just like, holy shit, we have to start doing music for real. So I go to class and I tell my three friends, you're gonna rap, you're gonna manage us, and I'm gonna be the producer and I'm gonna go find some beats for y'all, right? Not knowing what the fuck I'm doing at all. All I did was go home, found out about this website, soundclick.com. I didn't have a CD burner. I had a little Fisher-Price tape recorder, so I held the mic up to the computer speaker and just recorded like four or six beats that I liked and just brought the tape to school the next day, right? But that was really the origin of when I was like, all right, let's actually try to take the steps to record a song, not just write down lyrics and just rap them to each other, which is what we had been doing for most of middle school, just like keeping a notebook of just lyrics and we just like rap to each other, but we're not really trying to record or even make a song yet. That was the first inkling I got that I need to start trying to make some fucking songs.
Were you the most gung-ho though? Were you the most ambitious and serious out of everybody in that group?
I mean, I'm the only one still making music. Yeah, definitely.
Have you ever thought about making a song using that Rolls Royce sample?
Using what sample?
In Oh Boy. That's a Rolls Royce, I'm Going Down. Remember that song? I'm going down. That's
where
that
came from. Oh, yes. I love that song. Actually, nah, I've never even thought about reaching out to that because that felt like at the time, you know, that like song is so big, it kind of feels obvious, but maybe we're getting to the point where it's just old school enough that it could be kind of fresh. A lot of people seem to be sampling them like early 2000s.
I think it's personal.
But you know
enough.
What? Personal or not, I think personal can't always dictate your art, in my opinion. I think it's about what best serves the art and what best serves the project. You know what I mean?
It'd almost be like an homage, though, the first beat that really got you to take it serious, though. It's like a full circle thing.
Yeah, man. Yeah, it could be cool if we do it in an interesting way, you feel me?
And what high school did you go to after this?
I went to Carnegie Vanguard.
But was it it was Jones High School. Was you graduated from the Vanguard program?
Yeah, it was Jones, but by the time that I started going there, they had broke off. Like, I was the first class to go through fully Carnegie Vanguard when it was at its old campus in Sunnyside. So I never got to go to high school when it was at Jones, which is where I believe Screw went to high school.
In Southeast Houston, right?
Yeah.
See, I was hoping.
Yeah, Carnegie was still in Southeast Houston, but it wasn't Jones anymore.
I was hoping you went to Yates because that's where Booker T went.
That's right. Yates is my neighborhood school. Yates is where my brother went.
Yeah. Booker T came out of the Third Ward,
Yates
too.
Is where. Yeah, man. A lot of greats came out of Third Ward, for real.
Yeah. I mean, now he wants to run for mayor, which is crazy. But if Kane can become mayor of Tennessee, I guess anything's possible. Just some regular Jeremy Bigsby's, I guess.
Hey, man, I believe in Booker T. You know what I mean? I made a zine a few years ago called Found Me, and we actually interviewed Booker T, and he was gracious enough to give us a whole heap of his time and gave us this photo of him and Muhammad Ali, which has never been published. It's only in this little zine that me and my friends made like a couple hundred copies of.
It's funny because the only thing I know about Booker T is he came from Third Ward, and they call Third Ward the Harlem of Texas. So maybe calling them Harlem Heat, that's not a coincidence.
That is interesting. That is very interesting.
Maybe I'm reaching.
Hey, man, reaching is all we do as artists. But Third Ward is definitely a place that I could compare to the heyday of like Harlem, like a place that just harbors a lot of artists, thinkers, politicians, lawyers, doctors, singers, musicians. You know, it's all type of revolutionary minds coming out of Third Ward. And I think it's been that way historically.
But you went to high school in the Fourth Ward.
No, now Carnegie is in the Fourth Ward. But when I went there, it was at a different campus, and it was in Sunnyside, which is like more southeast, like not too far from where Jones is. But now it's in Fourth Ward, which is like Midtown Houston. So this is like new Carnegie that has like hundreds of kids going there. And it's like in like the middle of like downtown. That was not my experience at all. When I went there, there were like 300 kids in the whole school. There were like 20 some kids in my graduating class. It was in fucking Sunnyside. It was next door to a horse ranch in the middle of the hood. It was a totally different experience than what Carnegie kids are going through now.
Well, I heard McGregor Park is kind of like that. It's like an oasis in the middle of a bunch of hoods and crime and shit, but everyone takes care of the park.
I mean, well, I wouldn't even say it's in the middle of a bunch of crime and all shit, because it's right next door to the University of Houston and right by TSU. And, you know, I would say it's just a neighborhood park, you know, like crime and shit. I would say it's about the same amount of crime as any neighborhood, but I wouldn't say it's like a, you know, it's not like a, it's like not like a random beautiful thing that's in a shithole okay. spot.
I don't know why I assume that.
Hey, man, a lot of people, you know, Houston, I would say Houston is a big, major, well-known city, but I think a lot of the intricacies of our culture and our neighborhoods isn't really out there. Like, these are things I think people know if they have lived in Houston, especially Houston back in the day, because it has changed a lot, right? So I think that you can't really know unless you are from there. Like I don't think that there's anything on the internet that, you know, says that Carnegie was at a different place back in the day when like I went there. Like, that is all just lost to time. You know what I mean?
I think it's when you make records named after parks, it's people's introductory. Like Odyssey did Rock Creek Park, and I don't go to Maryland, so my introduction to Rock Creek Park is through artists like you guys.
Totally, nah, man, totally. And I think that McGregor Park is a great place to be introduced to Houston, especially to the south side of Houston, because all around that park you have Third Ward, you have South Park. You have the University of Houston, you have TSU, you have the Museum District not too far away, like you have downtown not too far away, and that park has a historic tennis court and basketball court that's on the same level as like the Rucker in fucking New York City or something, you know? So really, you're in a spot where you can touch a lot of important parts of Houston culture and history. and it's right where I grew up. So I would start there too, you know?
Well, when we talk about the origin of like Houston rap, you know, we could talk about South Park Coalition all day, but for me, really, it was Rick Rubin had the ear, Jay Prince had the vision. You know, Jay Prince had the business acumen to put Houston on the map, because there wasn't even a hip hop act in Houston that had released more than one record. He was the first one to do it. Ghetto Boys were the first group to release multiple records and then grow and then release an album, blow up locally, regionally, nationally, the next big thing, you know, and they're a platinum act and they're known all over the world. Mine Playing Tricks on Me was 30 years ago. And I think that galvanized a whole generation in Houston.
Totally. I think Rap-A-Lot doesn't get enough credit because they are really something else as a record label. Like, I think they not only provided a home for all these artists and all these albums, but I think they had a hand in A&Ring many of those albums. You know, putting a lot of the right producers in the right place is just half the battle. And I think that it's no surprise that labels like them or Cash Money or No Limit or Def Jam in its heyday had these in-house producers and had this sound and was really making sure that every record that left out of there met a certain quality, from the writing to just the creativity to just how it just sounded, the mixing, the mastering, like all that Rap-A-Lot shit sounds so good because you have Mike Dean and N.O. Joe and a lot of great people behind the boards there. And you have Jay Prince, who isn't just putting out acts that are super commercial or super whatever. Like, he's putting artists out there that, you know, make pretty much what I would call outsider music. You know, I look at a lot of Texas music like that, from Screw to Blackie to Jandek to Ghetto Boys and Devin the Dude and many more.
Yeah, and Scarface is now another politician. So crazy how that works out.
Hey, man. At least he's a good storyteller, you know. The fucking worst, at his worst, you know what I mean? He's gonna spit it to me in a way that I can appreciate as a citizen.
At night I can't sleep, I toss and turn, candlesticks in the dark, visions of bodies being burned. Four walls just staring at a nigga, I'm paranoid sleeping with my finger on the trigger.
But what I got from it is, like, it's funny that you learn to be independent from a punk band, because Jay Prince created Ghetto Boys. They were a group that evolved from one lineup to another lineup and continued to change until they arrived with Willie D, Scarface, Bushwick Bill, DJ Domo. But people in Houston saw that you could take your money wherever it came from, whether you had street money, dirty money, drug money, used car lot money, whatever it was, you could take it and you started investing it in people and in ideas, and then you could build your own label and build your own business.
Hell yeah. I think that I saw it from punk bands first, because I think punk is louder about being DIY and being independent and stuff. And I think as a kid, I would hear rap in all the same places as I would hear like a top 40 rapper. So I didn't really know that Scarface was, you know, on an independent label. I just knew that he was from Houston. He was on the radio and he was popping too. But with bands like Minor Threat, it's really from the interviews with these bands. That's how I learned how they were getting down. That's how I learned that they were doing shit themselves and like saving up money, buying a van to go on tour and doing all this shit. You know what I mean? That really wasn't put out there in rap till I started learning more about it. Like, because I even found out about punk music as underground music before I even knew about underground rap music. I didn't even know that there was a whole underground side to rap music until like a year or two later. Like, maybe I think I first heard MF Doom and realized that Rap-A-Lot was an independent label and that certain artists were independent, maybe in like the ninth grade. I found out about punk music and all that type of shit in like middle school, where I knew that, oh, these people were not on the radio, definitely. You know what I mean? So that's where the inspiration came from.
Oh yeah. I, cause you know, we're pretty much the same age. We grew up in Texas. I remember vividly where I realized that it was 15 years ago. I was watching 106 in Park and Big Mo Purple Stuff was the new joint of the day, and everyone booed it. And I was like, really? Yes, we're on TV.
People booed it?
They didn't get it because it was New York. They didn't get it.
You're kidding. It got booed. No way. What?
Like Free was like, what do y'all think of the new joint? They're like, boo. But I was jumping up and down like
that. Wow, man. I bet Houston people were mad about that. I bet Houston people were mad as fuck about that.
I don't think it was until Still Tipping to where people kind of got on board with what Houston was doing. But I remember that and I was like, man, we made it. I don't care if they're booing. We're on TV.
Yeah, man. Hey, man, gotta take the bitter with the sweet. Life of an artist.
So if I have an album and I want OG Ron C to make a screw and shot version, is it as cheap as I think? Or would I have sticker shock if you told me the amount?
Man, I don't know what he is charging, but I can tell you that he charged me $600 back in the day, which I think is a very fair amount for chopping the whole record. And that's probably such a deal compared to what he's charging now. Or was even charging then, and he was just showing me love. You know what I mean?
But I had $500 written on my paper, so that's pretty good.
Close enough, man. Close enough. You know, I think for like a cool $500, something that's not a big ask, you can get a lot of shit done.
You know, if Lil Wayne was like, hey, I want a screwed and chopped version, I bet he charged a little bit more. I think it depended on the artist.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
There's another guy in this mix named Michael Price. Does that name ring a bell?
No, who is that?
So Michael Price, who, like DJ Screw, was a big enthusiast of slowing things down. Unfortunately, he was murdered in 1993. But before that, he and Screw together were pursuing their own lanes and slowing things down. What Price did is he played tapes through a boombox with a screw pressed up against a motor to slow it down. And that's where Screw took the name from.
Oh, interesting. I never knew about that.
DJ Screw slowed down his music with the pitch control on his turntables, but that's where he got the idea. It was a very crude way of slowing down the music.
That's very cool. Man, Screw is one of my heroes for real, for real.
But so 04 is when you started making music. First project came out early 08. Proper album was 2010. Yes. That's the timeline. 2008 was interesting because the year your first project came out, you actually left Houston.
Yeah, that is not when I first moved out, but that's the first time I ever like got on a plane. I ever left the state of Texas, and I was going to Atlanta to work with Goldeneye because I met him at like the end of 2007. He came to Houston because he was in a group. And they were signed to Warner Brothers, and they were supposed to have some sessions with Mike Dean. But when I knew him only through MySpace. We had never met before. We had just communicated through MySpace, and we had talked on the phone a few times. And we started talking because I found out about his music, because the mentor to his group was the rapper Murs, who, when I was a kid, he was my favorite artist. And I found out through Murs that he had this new group of kids. They were from the South and he's working with them. I checked out their mixtape. I fucking loved it. I thought, wow, finally, these are some young people who are doing music like me. And I feel like we have a lot of the same ideas about music. Like many of them were first gen Americans like me. On their MySpace, they would list artists that influenced them, like 3-6 Mafia, Neil Young, My Bloody Valentine, The Smiths, UGK, Mac Dre, E-40. I'm just like, damn, I ain't never seen somebody else put... Oh, and also 80s artists like Slick Rick or Houdini. I'm like, damn, I've never seen somebody put these artists together that I really fuck with. So I started rocking with them. Goldeneye's coming to Houston to work with Mike Dean. It is December of 2007, and Pimp C passes away tragically. Because Pimp C passed, Mike Dean shut down all of his studio sessions, and now Goldeneye is in Houston during the holidays and he has hella free time. So we start kicking it. When we start kicking it, we find out that his mom is from Houston. His mom's family is from my neighborhood. They live a couple streets over from where I grew up. His aunt was my little brother's school teacher. Like, we had all these connections, right? And at the end of that trip, we decided to make a project together. It was like a side project for him. For me, it was what would become my first album. his group ended up breaking up. And over the next few years, from like 2008 to 2010, I would go to Atlanta, where he lived at the time, and then start going to Brooklyn, where we moved to. And we just worked on this album between those couple cities. And I'd come back to Houston and link up with my friends who have studios, and I'd have them record all my vocals.
So you and Goldeneye are a formidable force together. There's a very long and storied working relationship and friendship there. So I'm going to rattle some things off. You let me know if you know what the hell I'm talking about or it's nonsense. All right.
Hit me.
You guys got scanned in East New York?
Yes. Yes.
There's something called Molly C. Knight.
Yes, yes, yes. In LA, that's right.
In LA,
right, baby.
At water parties, endless barbecues.
Yes, that was 2012. That's when I first moved to LA. And we had a house in Atwater Village where we live there. At first, we had another crib where we built a studio in, but that place didn't work out. So we moved into this Atwater spot, and it was a big ass house with like 12 folks living there. And we had the times of our lives. I had a crazy fucking party for my 24th birthday. It was quite a thrill. And Goldeneye definitely was often barbecuing in there.
I know that jamming Nothing in Common, bringing 17 young ladies home from the club. Remember when that guy did coke off his girlfriend's butt looking lame? Then he had,
oh my God. Yes.
He had a kid with Tennelly. You was the godfather. Then the session with Telly and Stuntman, and some guy had no idea what was going on in this house. Last but not least, your bike accident.
Yes. Yes. That bike act, man, you are pulling stories from all over. This is so wild. But that bike accident was when I went to Atlanta in 2008. And that was like one of the first few days that I was there, and definitely the last time that I rode a bike down the fucking hill.
But I mean, so that's me summing up a 15-year friendship. I'm sure you got stories on top of stories.
That's incredible, man. Where'd you get all that? That is sick.
Hey, man, when Fat Tony comes on your podcast, you got to do your research. It's the only way.
Love it. Love it, man. Love it.
I told her I can answer anything she desires. She said we can't be getting freaky or she'll be buying. But I was an artist running like forest in a forest that she admired.
You are going deep because honestly, some of these stories are so funny. They need to be told. But on the other hand, I kind of feel like some of them are just dumb inside jokes at this point. But those are great too. And I think if you're down to give us a fucking ear, we'll tell them all to you.
I think a big thing I respect about you is Mike Jones and Paul Wall and all those guys. I'm not sure if that's who they are or if they were just playing a role they expected Houston wanted them to play. You know, are they really in the lean and slabs and grills and shit? A good example is DJ DMD. He produced 25 Lighters. Everybody knows that song. And when 25 Lighters blew up, he admitted that he wasn't mentally or spiritually prepared for it. He was a clean-cut kid. But when hip-hop took that hard turn, he became enraptured by it. He wanted to be a gangster. Everybody was thugging, so that's what he did. And he started to believe his own lies. He got wrapped up in a lifestyle he couldn't get out. His wife left him. Nobody wanted to work with him. He went broke, and then he became a born-again Christian and ultimately retired from rap. Now, that's one man's story, but you never felt like you had to make music that Scarface was making or Zero or Big Hawk. You were always unapologetically you. No grills. No Vogues wrapped in fofos, just Fat Tony, and I respect that.
Thank you. Thank you very much, man. I mean, it's definitely always been very important to me to have your own sound. You know, I think that every artist should have their own sound. I think every artist should strive to stand out, and I think that you can always go further if you have that, because just trying to fit in with that current sound, you'll get lost in that, and then when that passes, you know, then there's no reason to really look back at your work when your work is you mimicking other work that actually was original. at one point, and that's why it's what's going on, and that's why people are fucking with it, because it's the thing of the moment. But it doesn't mean you need to fall into it and become it if that's not who you naturally are as an artist.
So when you go to record Smart Ass Black Boy, did you get out of Houston so maybe you wouldn't have lived a similar fate like DJ DMD?
I don't know. I kind of felt like I needed to just like see more, because at that point I like still lived at home. I had never lived on my own. I had never really been to like LA more than just a couple times. And I thought that that's a place where I could actually start this like journey that becomes an actual music career. You know, I didn't have like anything going on in my life where I felt like I need to get away from this or like run from like some kind of demons or whatever, or any kind of violence or any drama, like anything, you know. I was just still just like young and like hungry.
So after high school, you're drawn to psychology and you go to university.
Yes.
And you become the vice president of the Black Student Union.
Yes.
as the vice president of the Black Student Union, let me ask you, if I'm a black artist and I have an all-white audience, do you still think that that's setting a bad example of a black man? Before This Is America, you felt Childish Gambino was a slap in the face to black people. How do you feel about him now?
Man, I actually feel like he is one of the artists who has been most improved in my book. And I think it's more so from his other work and not really his music. You know what I mean? I was not a fan of his music then. I'm still not a big fan of his music now, but I love Atlanta and I love his creativity. But I felt like at the time, some of the stuff that he was saying in his music and looking at his audience just kind of felt like, just like didn't feel like a good fit for me at the time.
Okay. Was your dad wasn't impressed by your position as a vice president of that union?
I don't even know if he even knew about it or like cared. I feel like he would only care if it was having to do with like grades or something. You know what I mean?
Well, I mean, because it helps on the
fuck about nothing that's extracurricular. Okay,
because I mean, you even went to the University of Houston after that, and then you know, if it seems like you're on the path to being like higher academia. So when you pivot to a full time artist, he probably didn't take it too well, because Nigerians are intellectual beings almost by default.
Exactly. And I don't think that he really respected the intellect in my music genre. You know, my dad likes music, but his music of choice is like country music, reggae. You know, he looks at those artists with like, you know, these are great minds putting together some awesome work. But he's just too old to even get rap music. You know what I mean? There was a certain point where I just had to realize that my parents were of a generation where rap music just kind of doesn't make any sense to them.
But anything that you've done to where, I mean, you haven't had a real job in 10 years. You've been in the entertainment industry. So if you've been able to sustain yourself with success, they have to at least be proud of you on that front.
Absolutely. They absolutely are, especially nowadays.
It's funny, like, I don't know much about Nigeria, but they just banned Twitter in their country.
I saw that. That was fucking crazy. It's like a police state over there.
I guess that's telling of what's going on. Like, they discarded Twitter as a news source, and you can actually get arrested for using it.
Yeah, that ain't right at all.
The ban has made young people fearful of the country's future. And I think they're going through the same shit we went through with Donald Trump, because their president Buhari is tweeting some wild shit and is getting removed. So I don't know what's going on over there.
Sick, sad world.
Well, let me ask you, a decade ago, your grandmother died. Have you gotten around to writing a song about her life and memory?
I actually haven't. Nothing that's like, there's like something that I wrote around the time that was kind of like personal, but you know, I did talk about her a bit on this EP I put out in 2018 called Full Circle, but I wouldn't say that like song stands as like an ode to her, just like a verse where I talked about how I felt at that time in my life. I've probably expressed that in ways I didn't even know at the moment. You know what I mean? Like, there's many times where I write a song and like say the song's about a character. You know, like all the songs on my last album, which are all written from like the viewpoint of like someone that's not me. But sometimes I feel when I write from that perspective and I'm performing the songs, I can think about those actual emotions that happened to me and then filter that through the lyrics of this character I'm playing. And that feels like a true, real ass, you know, expressing a real ass release. Like that's when I feel like the feeling is actually coming through. Cause there's sometimes where I try to make it top of mind and I want to write something, you know, that is directly about a personal thing I went through. And I feel like it can get kind of trite or feel kind of like you're phoning it in.
And that's kind of, this is a good segue because I want to talk about Exotica. It's almost the opposite of that because it's your self-proclaimed best album.
What do you think though?
You know what? I'm going to be honest. I like the album. I like the older stuff more. The older stuff, like 2011, 2012.
Like what? Rabdar Gap?
Maybe there's nostalgia attached to it. And maybe it's a skewed point of view.
Well, I don't think that's bad either, because the fact that you've been listening to me for that long and you're still rocking with me today is a testament. And I think when you love the music that made you first fall in love with somebody, I think that's only natural.
It's tough because this last album is a body of work about redemption, addiction, and desire. And I can't personally connect with those themes, even though I hear it. Mm-hmm. So it might be something that would need to marinate with me a little bit more, if I'm being honest. It's tough to ask that question with your old fans, you know?
No, I think that the old fans are the ones that you want to hear it from the most, because they probably get you the most or they love you the most, you know?
What I will say is I like the mariachi version, because that mariachi organization, it's new. He just created that during the pandemic. So I think you took advantage of some hungry kids that promote diversity and culture. And I think that was a good mix.
Definitely, yeah. I mean, I think it's beautiful just to hear our music in like a different form, in like a more lush form. You know, it was eye opening.
You got one up to Kenny Rogers. I'm sorry. And that, and that cover art reminds me of some old Sonic Youth albums. So it's all good.
Oh, really? Interesting. I love Sonic Youth, but I would have not made that connection. That is tight, though.
What? But I did hear that Bun B straight up ditched his wife on vacation on her birthday to walk to your Airbnb and record a verse, which I think that's hilarious, because his wife was probably like, of course you know somebody with a booth in Jamaica. Fine, just go. Just go knock it out.
Hey, man, sometimes you got to rap.
Here's a real question, though. Bun knocked out that verse in 30 minutes, all gravy, but Bun is a legend, and he could have whoopity-scoop, poopity-scooped a verse on your song. Would you have still kept it? Would you have intervened if the verse wasn't up to your standards or like whatever Bun lays
down? Absolutely.
Okay. Absolutely. You looked up to UGK. So it might have been one of that starstruck moment like, oh, I don't want to offer up any criticism. Whatever he lays down is good enough. But
I don't believe in that with any music making or any art. Everything has to be examined with the same level of detail and care and just make it good, you know. It don't matter who the fuck it is. If it doesn't fit the song, it doesn't fit the song. You got to be honest.
And it fits the song. It's a great opener for sure.
Thank you.
Is there anything else that you want to say about the album for people who haven't heard it and need to pick it up? You have the floor.
I would say if you have an interest in storytelling and creativity and just something different musically, you know, I think we're in a world right now where more than ever, so much rap music sounds the fucking same. And I think that this is an album where me and Gold and I both tried to really push ourselves to do something that is unique even to us. And that's kind of the guidelines that we're going to continue pushing with. So if you like that, check out my new album, Exotica, and that Gangnam Man Mariachi remix.
Now that I got Fat Tony on the podcast and Prince Paul has been on the podcast, I have the two best Aries musicians in the game.
That's what I'm always saying, man. I fucking love Prince Paul. He's the shit. He's the fucking truth. Dude, man, I got to give it up to you, man. I talk to a lot of people. The amount of detail and things that you've pulled up in this, it is a real joy to hear somebody that's like actually read up and gone through all this shit. This is dope. Thank you.
I challenge you. Don't do interviews with people that aren't fans, man. Yeah, because your time is valuable.
Nah, that's straight up. Straight up, man.
The last thing I'll say is, like I said, I'm moving out to Houston. Put me on that VIP list because me and my wife are going to see you at the White Oak Music Hall in October. We've been in the damn house. Man, we've been in the house for 2 years. I'm going to explore my new city, and I'm going to start with supporting Fat Tony. So what better way, man?
Hell yeah.
Appreciate you being here.
Hell yeah.
All right, man. And I got some barbecue with your name on it, man. So let's set that up.
If only we could get together right now.
I appreciate your time, man, for being here.
Thank you, brother. Thank you so much, man. Peace.